Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
They may not be elected to office, but they serve the public and have an undetermined amount of political power. Today, a look at the roles of our first ladies in the White House and in the governor's mansion in Richmond. Welcome to Virginia Conversations. I'm May Lily Lee. We begin with an author who has done extensive research into the women behind the men who have become president. Feather Schwartz Foster is author of the book First Ladies, From Martha Washington to Mamie Eisenhower, an intimate portrait of the women who shaped America. Feather joins us from our Richmond studio. Welcome to Virginia Conversations.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
It's fun to start these off with you because you have such a grasp not only of the first ladies in general, but you know the ties to Virginia. And there aren't a lot of them, but a great place to start is Martha Washington.
She was the first.
Tell me a little about Martha. We hear so much about the man. Let's hear about the woman behind the man.
Well, Martha was born and raised in Virginia. She lived here all her life except for, you know, brief, quote, semi-residences in New York and in Philadelphia. But she was Virginia born down in the Tidewater, New Kent County area. Her family was gentry rather than terribly wealthy, but she married for the first time a man named Daniel Park Custis, who was very, very wealthy. And when he died about 7 years into their marriage, Martha inherited a great deal of property. And she also had two little babies at the time, 4 and 2. And then she married George Washington, and they moved to his place, which was Mount Vernon. And she, from the get-go, was a very domestic woman. She could manage that plantation, and she did it elegantly and well, from the kitchens to the guest houses and the guest accommodations. And they entertained extensively. And she was a real helpmeet and helpmate to George.
Now, the first lady who followed Martha was Abigail Adams, but she was a real contrast to Martha.
Very different. And they got to be good friends when, you know, at a later point in their life when Martha was first lady and Abigail was the second lady as wife of the vice president. But they were very, very different. Abigail Adams, the Adamses did not have anywhere near the wealth of the Washingtons. They had a small house, certainly in comparison, small piece of property in comparison. And Abigail, while she was domestic enough, I mean, she took care of her own place pretty much. But Abigail was far more intellectually inclined. She was much more of a reader than Martha. Martha read, she read the newspapers and she read somewhat, but Abigail was an avaricious reader. She was a big-time reader, and she liked the tough subjects. She liked politics. She liked economics. She liked philosophy. They were just different people, but they get on very, very well.
So we're painting Abigail Adams as having book smarts, and she's more intellectual. Would you say that Martha Washington had street smarts?
Martha Washington knew how to do, quote, her job as wife, as mistress of a plantation, and as mistress of whatever was taking the place of the White House. The Washingtons never did live in Washington itself or the White House. It was being built at the time. But the president's mansion or house, as you would call it, in both Washington and in Philadelphia, she knew how to run it. She knew how to manage it. She knew how to entertain the wives. She had to sort of wing it a lot because there were no precedents for her to follow. Nobody had done it before her. And she had a very, very fine line to follow, and it was this. She couldn't be too regal. She couldn't be too aloof or imposing because that would smack of royalty. And we had just fought a big war to throw over a monarchy, so she didn't want to be concerned about being monarchical in her tendencies. But by the same token, she could not be as warm and as pleasant and welcoming as she was, say, as mistress of Mount Vernon, because to do that would make her too familiar, and that wasn't quite right either. It was a very fine line, and she did it extremely well.
Feather, I know you won't mind if I become a little bit of a dirt digger. The alleged affair between George Washington and Sally Fairfax, truth or fiction?
No affair here. There was no affair. You have to remember that, number one, his, infatuation with Sally Fairfax was taking place when he was about 18 or 19 years old. He was still a kid. Granted, they grew up faster and they matured earlier than they do now, but he was still only 18, 19, 20, maybe even into his 20s. And for the most part, Sally may have teased him a little bit here and there, or she may have flirted some, but there was never even any of the slightest, dare I even use the word, consummation of anything. This was basically an infatuation on his part and a mild flirtation ducking on hers. There was no real big love affair here.
All right. Moving on from Martha Washington, while she holds the place in history as the first First Lady, this next First Lady with ties to Virginia really fascinates, if by personality alone, Dolly Madison.
Oh, Dolly C was super. She was the one who really put the role of First Lady on the map, as it were. Before that, both Martha and Abigail were the president's wives, their consorts. They were lovely ladies, but they were not, quote, a role that they actually fulfilled. Dolly was not born in Virginia. She was born in North Carolina, but her family moved back to Virginia. Her parents were both Virginians. And they had moved back to Virginia when she was little, and so she was raised here. She would live here for the rest of her life, except for when she was in Washington.
Okay. Continue.
Oh, and then when she became she married James Madison, she was a widow at that time. She had been living in Philadelphia. Her family moved there when she was about 15 years old. She married, and she was married for about 3 or 4 years, and her husband died in a yellow fever epidemic. And about a year later, she married James Madison, who was many years her senior, about 18 years older than she was. And it was a very happy marriage. It was a particularly happy marriage. When Thomas Jefferson became president in 1801, he asked Madison to become his Secretary of State. So they moved to Washington, and Dolly was sort of the de facto First Lady under Jefferson, who was a widower at the time. And his daughter, and actually both his daughters, one had died, they would come up occasionally and help entertain for Jefferson. But most of the time, when he needed a woman's touch or a woman to be his escort or whatever, he would use Dolly and James Madison to be his hostess. And Dolly just gravitated to that role. This was a duck to water. This was just absolutely right up her alley.
Now, back in that time, Dolly Madison was like any other wife. Not only could she not own property, women couldn't be property owners of any kind, but they also were considered the property of their husbands. So when Dolly's husband passed away, she fought to keep custody of her property.
Well, she did. I have read that for Virginia law, and I do not know about any of the other colonies, that if a widow inherits property, she may manage her own property. She does not need a legal guardian to do it. Dolly did inherit some property from her first husband. She rented out the house that they lived in. But by and large, she was only 25 years old, and she had a little two-year-old. She went back, and she was staying with her mother, who owned a boarding house at the time. And this is in the 1793, 4, 5, where Philadelphia was the capital of the United States, and the boarding house was containing a pile of congressmen, one senator, and the Secretary of State, Mr. Jefferson. So that's almost where she got her training to do hosting duties.
Okay. Dolly Madison. It's interesting, but if you could take the Myers-Briggs personality inventory, you know, you're either an I for an introvert or you're an E for extrovert. Dolly Madison probably would have truly pushed the scales on extroversion.
She was an extrovert, although, like most people, she did have a private side. She did have a side that was quiet. She did have a side that after a party was over, she would go, "Oh, I'm glad they went home," type of a thing, just like you might. But Dolly truly liked people. She enjoyed their company. She wanted to make them feel at home. She had some really wonderful personality qualities. She was not a gossip. She did not talk behind your back. If you told her something in confidence, it would stay confidential. These are very nice qualities to have. And oddly enough, and this is kind of rare, men liked her, and so did their wives and their mothers and their daughters. Women liked her just as much as men did. She was a good friend. She was a good person. They loved her.
As you wrote, Dolly was unparalleled at the softer side of politics. So she was,
yes,
in her own right, a good politician. Now, you mentioned she wasn't a gossip, but I'm going to be one.
Yes.
Were there controversies that she had to dodge?
There are always controversies. There was gossip that she was involved with the French minister and the this and that. You know how people gossip. But since there wasn't a shred of truth to it, she just really dodged it very nicely. She said, "Ha, ha, ha," and that was it. I think the sweetest story about Dolly is that she used to go to the to Congress, and she would sit in the congressional galleries and listen to the debates. And sometimes, frequently, she would bring some of her lady friends, and they would go and listen to the debates. And there was one story that they told about Senator somebody or Congressman somebody who did not like her husband at all. And Dolly's up there in the galleries, and this congressman is up there, and he is just regaling them with terrible things about her husband's and really embarrassing Dolly, you know, as you might imagine. And she was there. And then afterwards, they're looking at her saying, "What is she going to say after all this?" And she would go, "Well, that was a good show now, wasn't it?" And she totally dismissed it offhand, which was really key to her personality. That's the softer side of politics.
Some of this covers what you covered. You wrote, she knew everyone and everything that was going on, as did her predecessors, but Dolly made it easy for politicians and political opponents to meet informally in a neutral setting.
Yes, they did. Washington, D.C. at the time was a tiny little village. You only had a couple of hundred congressmen and 30, 40, not even senators. They did not have the infrastructure, and by that I not only mean roads and everything, but they didn't have – they had taverns, they had hotels, but they didn't have places where the political people, the political powers that be, could meet informally. You were either meeting formally or not at all, and that wasn't so good either. Politicians do need to get to know each other personally, and they need to be able to talk across political factions and lines. There weren't really political parties. The Federalists were dying. They really didn't have a lot of clout then. But they had different factions, and these different people had to be able to find a common ground. And Dolley, as the wife of the Secretary of State when Jefferson was president, and then later in the White House as First Lady, provided a place, provided a venue where all these people could come together in a basically neutral location, because nobody would want to offend Mrs. Madison by getting into an altercation or an argument, and they could talk, they could meet, they could greet, they could go off in a little corner and talk informally, and Dolley provided that. It was very important.
You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. This reminder, past editions of Virginia Conversations can be heard at virginiapublicradio.org. We're back with more in a minute. Talking with Feather Schwartz Foster, author of the book First Ladies from Martha Washington to Mamie Eisenhower, an intimate portrait of the women who shaped America. Now, you're based in Williamsburg. You go all over the state to do these lectures?
Well, I usually do. I've been doing mostly the peninsula and the Tidewater area. You know, Virginia's a big state.
Yes, it is. What's your web link?
It's www.featherfoster. That's feather with a foot. F-E-A-T-H-E-R. Featherfoster.com.
Feather like the bird. Now, my understanding is that you became interested in the First Ladies because you're a bibliophile. You love books.
I love books and I love presidential history. When we moved to Virginia, I live in Williamsburg, we put a room on the house when we moved in just for the library. It's a big room. It's 20 by 20. And I've got about 1,500 books just on the different presidents, and about another maybe 300-400 on the presidency and related subjects and social history of the U.S. What? And that doesn't count all our other books, too.
And what captured you? What drew you into the First Ladies?
They're more fun. Yeah, if you write about presidential history, you have to treat it very seriously, and you have to treat it scholarly, and you have to treat it academically, and you can't have a good time with them. With the First Ladies, there is so many ways that you can just enjoy them, because they were just lovely, wonderful ladies, and I really like writing about them.
We talked about how Dolley Madison and her husband were compatible. As we move to Rachel Jackson, how did she feel about Andrew and vice versa?
They were very deeply in love. Rachel's ties to Virginia were a little bit slender. She was born here. She was born in the western part of the state.
In Halifax County.
I don't think I've ever been there, so I don't really know exactly where it is. But she was born there, and they lived there until she was about 14 years old. Her father had served in the Revolutionary War, and they paid you in land. They paid a lot of the Revolutionary War officers in land, in free land. And her father wanted to claim this free land that they were giving away, and he led a party of his friends and neighbors down flatboats and in wagons, and they wound up in Tennessee. So she got to Tennessee when she was about 14.
And married
and
a man
she
did not like. The first husband was someone she did not like.
she was married. She had been married when she was about 17, and she grew to really not like him a lot. He was abusive, and he was very jealous, and she was unhappy. And they separated on and off a few times, and it was during one of these separations that she met Andrew Jackson, and they fell in love, and they stayed in love. And unfortunately, it's a very convoluted and muddied up situation for historians. I think they're trying to unravel some little pieces of it. But the upshot was that Rachel thought that she was divorced. Jackson thought that she was divorced because there had been some articles in the newspapers that her first husband had gotten a divorce.
I smell a scandal.
And there was a scandal. And so Jackson and Rachel get married, and about 3 years later, they find out that the divorce had not been granted or finalized or official or whatever it had to be. That you have to remember, this is back in 1790 in Tennessee, which wasn't even a state then. This is Daniel Boone time. This is out in the backwoods time. Transportation, communication was very slow, but it created this great scandal. Quickly, they remarried, so he is the first president to ever marry his wife twice, which is what he did. But it changed Rachel. She got to feel very guilty over it. And Jackson, knowing Andrew Jackson, got to be very angry over it. It did not change the love between them. It was always very, very dear, very, very tender. But it changed how they were. He became very, very protective of his wife's, quote, reputation, which he perceived as being smeared and sullied all over the place. And she became very reclusive and later in her life became extremely religious, maybe to a point of fanaticism a little bit. Very religious.
What about the impact that Rachel had on Andrew Jackson?
You know, one could ponder and one could wonder about what would Jackson have been like if Rachel had either been unmarried, a period, you know, and never had had a husband, or that the divorce had never been scandalized, or, in fact, he had never grown to prominence. You could ponder that forever, and you could conjecture it forever. The truth of the matter is she was, what should I say, sullied or perceived sullied by it. It was a huge scandal. And the reclusiveness of her did have quite an impact. He became extremely protective of her. And he became very generous and gentle toward her.
And as you
you
actually said he fought duels and he carried bullets on his body to protect her honor.
He did. He fought a couple of duels. All anybody, you know, Jackson was a hot-tempered Irishman. He truly was. And it didn't take much to trigger off his weak spot. And his enemies, and he had a lot of them, would find that the quickest way to his spleen was to say something inappropriate about Mrs. Jackson. And he would just go off into one of his little fits of pique, and he would challenge them to duels. He did fight duels, and he avoided a couple of duels as well. Jackson was a man who was destined to be a public man, and public men will have many, many admirers and just as many detractors.
Here's another public man, President John Tyler, and his wife, Julia Tyler. Now, of the ones that we've been discussing, we talked about Martha Washington. We talked about Dolly Madison, both of whom have ties to Virginia. Martha was born and raised in Virginia and lived her life in Virginia. Dolly Madison was born in North Carolina but raised in Virginia and lived her retirement years in this state. And Rachel Jackson, whom you said was born in Halifax County. But Julia Tyler, the wife of John Tyler, does not have any Virginia ties, except that chronologically she came next.
She came next in pretty much as far as First Lady. Jackson was a widower when he came to the White House. Martin Van Buren was a widower. William Henry Harrison didn't last very long. And John Tyler's first wife, also a Virginian, was a she was an invalid, and she died early into Tyler's presidency. But he remarried, and he, at age 54, married a 24-year-old New York girl, Julia Gardner. She was from Long Island, and her family was very, very loaded wealthy. And Julia, however, became an adopted daughter of Dixie, and she considered herself as much a Virginian as just about anybody. She loved it, and they grew to like her very much. She wasn't First Lady for very long. She's First Lady for only about 8 or 9 months, and then Tyler's term of office was over. So they come back to Virginia. By that time, he had bought a plantation down on the peninsula in Charles City County called Sherwood Forest, which is still there, and it's still visitable, and it's very lovely, by the way. And she became mistress of Sherwood Forest. Now, the interesting thing about Julia is that she was a New Yorker, and her Virginia neighbors sort of looked a little bit askance at, well, she's not from Virginia, you know. But she was such a delightful lady. She just slipped right into the whole social scheme of very social lady. And she was happy to take her place on the social calendar and happy to open their home to return invitations and barbecues and parties and all that. They grew to accept her very, very much. And during the Civil War, she became a real adopted daughter of Dixie, so much so that when she went back to New York, when McClellan's army was coming down the peninsula, Tyler had died. They're married right by that time, about 15 years, and she's got 7 children of her own, the youngest being still little babies, you know, a year old, 2 years old. She went back up to New York basically to get her family to safety, but she didn't like New York any better by that time. She didn't like it very much at all, and the New Yorkers didn't like her much either, because she was very much an adopted daughter of Dixie and an ardent Confederate. And as soon as the war was over, she came back to Sherwood Forest, and she would live there for several years. It was kind of a mess. It hadn't been burned, but it had been vandalized. And it required much more attention and money than she had at the time. And eventually she went and she lived in Richmond.
The next couple is the Woodrow Wilson couple.
Yes, and this is the second Mrs. Wilson.
And I don't mean next chronologically. I mean
no.
In terms of our list of Virginia ties.
Yes, and she is, I think, the last of the Virginia born or raised or seriously tied first ladies. Edith Bowling Galt Wilson was born in Wytheville right after the Civil War, about 5 or 6 years after the Civil War ended. And her father was a judge. And she was one of 9 children, I believe. And she was down at the lower end. She was the 7th, I think, of the 9 children. And as most people know, after the Civil War, Virginia was a mess. It had been really ravaged by war. And since she was low in the birth order, and the Bowlings were a prosperous family, certainly before the war, but after the war they were, I think the term that they used then was genteel poverty. You know, they had a lot of prestige and they had a lot of pedigree, but they didn't have a lot of money. Edith's education as a young girl was sort of they weren't going to send her off to higher education. They were sort of hoping she'd just make an advantageous marriage. Now, there's something you have to know about Edith Bowling. That was her maiden name. I do not know if she is related in any way to the Lieutenant Governor Bowling, but it's a very, very old family, and I suppose if both of them go back far enough, they probably will. But Edith was a big gal. She was about 5'9", which was pretty tall. And she was attractive, but she was a big gal. And when she was 24 years old, she married a man named Norman Galt. And it was a happy marriage. If he hadn't died, they'd still be married. But he did die. He died about 12 years into their marriage. And she became a widow. She was just perfectly fine. About that time, Woodrow Wilson had been elected president. And a year and a half after he moved into the White House in 1913, his first wife died. And he was just a total mess. And about 8 months after Ellen died, he meets Mrs. Galt, the widow Galt. This is a real romantic story. Now, you have to take a fast detour over to Woodrow Wilson. He was a very complicated man, very psychologically complicated. He is one of our most intellectual presidents. He's also one of our most psychologically complex presidents.
Are you saying he dealt with emotional issues?
He had big emotional needs. And he felt emotional things very, very deeply.
I hear the eggshells cracking under your feet.
Oh.
Yeah, just
well,
because you are.
Well, he was fragile. Yeah, you're right. He was a fragile man that way. And he needed nurturing is what he needed. He needed a woman's nurturing touch. He had been raised by a devoted mother. He had two older sisters who were devoted to him, who thought the sun rose and set on him. His first wife was very nurturing, whose life just revolved around. He needed that in his life. There go the eggshells. You're absolutely right. And he was devastated when his first wife died. He had three daughters who also worshipped the ground he worked on, but two of them were married and starting, you know, lives of their own, and his third daughter also had a little bit of a career of her own. She did not really want to stay in Washington.
Edith actually filled the bill. She was able to deliver, and they were mutually in love with each other.
Oh, they fell wildly in love. Woodrow had asked a cousin of his, a woman in her late 30s at the time who was unmarried, and it was his cousin, and he said, you know, after his first wife died, come stay in the White House, take care of my social obligations, I'm a mess. So she came, and she was the one who had become friends with Edith Galt, quite by coincidental. She had a girlfriend. They would go to lunch together. They would go shopping. They would become friends. One time when they were out shopping or lunching or something, they got caught in a rainstorm, and Helen Bones, who was Woodrow's cousin, said, oh, we're right near the White House. Why don't you come in and we'll have tea? And Edith says, oh, that would be lovely. I've never been in the White House. She'd been living in Washington for 20 years, but her social set never really got into politics or political circles. So they go and they have tea. And who do they meet on the way up to the family quarters to have tea? But they meet the president, who promptly invites himself to the tea party. And he meets Mrs. Galt. And the story is that they had a very lovely hour and conversation and tea, and they had been discussing a particular book. And the very next day, Woodrow Wilson obtains a copy of the book from the Library of Congress, and he sends it to, Dear Mrs. Galt, blah, 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 nice meeting you. And here is a copy of the book we were discussing. Sincerely yours, Woodrow Wilson. Which is a perfectly nice, pleasant thing to do. but he has been enamored. And the next letter in the chronology, not all that long after, would be a Dear Edith, I love you type of a letter.
That was
he
quick.
He falls in love with – real fast. Knocked her socks off. But by the same token, when he first met his first wife, Ellen, he fell in love with her immediately and immediately hard and complete.
How long were Edith and Woodrow together?
Until he died.
Wonderful. Now, we've and got a comprehensive look at Martha Washington.
Yes.
Dolly Madison, Rachel Jackson, Edith Wilson, Julia Tyler. I have a quiz for our listeners. You can't really call in. You just have to consider this. Which of the first ladies was really a counterfeit? She wasn't actually a first lady, not technically anyway. All right. Consider that, and now go ahead, Feather, with the answer.
Okay, well, the first one who was a little bit of a counterfeit would have been Rachel Jackson. She was first lady because when Jackson was elected, she was living. He was elected in November. He was inaugurated in March, and she died right around Christmas time. So she never quite made it to the White House. But Jackson being Jackson, at least I personally feel that he was so devoted to Rachel and he hated anybody slandering her or even that he might even perceive it to be a snub of any kind. I would not want him to be on my bad side, so I always include Rachel in my mix.
Good one. Now, this is a non-Virginia tie, but worth mentioning. Elizabeth Monroe was a first lady who followed Dolly and was, by contrast, very unpopular.
Yes, she was. She did live in Virginia after at varying times. She was a New Yorker, and she was a very, very sophisticated woman. Her father was a British officer who stayed in this country after the French and Indian War. And early on in her career, she was in Europe with Monroe because he had several diplomatic posts. She did live down here near Monticello. The Monroe's home was in that area. I'm not sure if it's still in the same county as Monticello, but I know it's within only a few miles. And she lived there, and she seemed to have been happy enough, but she was not a popular first lady. Number one, Dolly Madison is a very hard act to follow. Right off the bat, anybody is going to pale in comparison. And Elizabeth Monroe did not have that much of an outgoing personality. She was a little bit on the reclusive side, certainly on the quiet side. There is some conjecture that she had some health problems. We know very little about Elizabeth Monroe, very little. I think one of the few things that we know is that she was a small person. She was under 5 feet tall. She was a tiny little thing. And one of the things about her is that because of all this overseas diplomatic experience where she was actively in association with the monarchies, with Napoleon and the French Empire and all, she gravitated to their formalities. And she decided when she became First Lady, she did not have Dolly Madison's very democratic, with a small d, attitude of calling on you, and I'll go and visit you, and you come and visit me. Elizabeth Monroe believed that the First Lady was on a par with a royal family. You know, if you're the president, you are the equal, the social equal of anybody who's a king or a crown prince or whatever. Anybody who would like can come and call on her, but she was not going to return the calls.
She wasn't popular, but
no.
Did James Monroe find something endearing in her? And that's going to have to be a one-sentence answer as we round out.
Yes, he loved her very much.
Oh, how about that? This just seems to be a love story after love story. We should have aired this at Valentine's Day. We are talking with Feather Schwartz Foster, the author of the book First Ladies, From Martha Washington to Mamie Eisenhower, An Intimate Portrait of the Women Who Shaped America. I want to thank you so much for joining us. A pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you very much, too.
You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Still to come, the Virginia First Lady who chose to move out of the executive mansion for the sake of generations to come. Stay with us. We're back in 90 seconds.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Virginia Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.
One glamorous part of being a first lady is the opportunity to enjoy living in a historic mansion. But for Virginia Governor Jim Gilmore and his wife Roxanne, it was more of a challenge than a luxury. When they moved into the executive mansion in 1998, it was in dire need of major renovations. So they decided it was time to move out and let the experts in for a top-to-bottom renovation. This year, the executive mansion celebrates its bicentennial, 200 years of being called home by Virginia's governors, and the mansion is basking in its glory. Roxanne Gilmore's self-imposed exile to save the mansion prompted her to author a book on the project. It's entitled Restoring the Virginia Governor's House, Preserving a Historic Home for a New Century. And Roxanne joins us now from our Richmond studio. Welcome to Virginia Conversations.
Well, thank you, May Lily. I appreciate your having me today. This is one of my favorite topics. The project became really a part of my life for the whole time that we were at the mansion, and I enjoyed going back through as I wrote the book and really remembering all of the people that worked so hard to make the project a success.
I know that you were displaced, but were you ever able to reside in the mansion?
We were. In fact, the time that we were out was really only 6 months. Part of the largest reason that the house project was a success was that we did an 18-month pre-construction phase while we still lived there to identify all of the problems so that there wouldn't be any surprises when we moved out. And the project itself took 2 years, and then we were back in the mansion for the last 2 years.
There's a website connected to the project, VirginiaGovernorsHouse.com, and I want to quote from it. The Virginia Governor's House is singular. Built in 1813, it is the oldest continuously occupied executive mansion in the nation and basks in the shadow of the magnificent state capitol designed by Thomas Jefferson. While other states were inclined to move their chief executives into homes in different settings that were neither historically significant nor easily accessible to the public, Virginia held fast to the notion that the first site in historic Capitol Square was the best site for the governor's family to reside. And folks can find out so much more about your book, but what I'm interested in is what launched the book for you.
Well, there's a lot written about the people that live there, about the governors and their families and that kind of thing. But I really wanted to, for this book, to be a book about the house itself and about the project and about the people that worked on the project that very often don't get recognized for all of the effort and all of the work that they put in to make the lives of people like me and my husband so much more enjoyable while we're there. And that was really a big driving motivation for me.
We should point out that this is a good marriage for you in terms of a marriage of interests because of your ties to Randolph Macon as a history professor. In fact, that was a really important point, that when you became First Lady, you didn't give up your day job.
That's right. I was surprised. It never occurred to me to stop teaching when I became First Lady, and then all of a sudden I was being bombarded with questions about, are you really going to do that? And nobody's ever done that before. I think that teaching is a valued profession. I think that being a teacher as First Lady really highlights that profession and those people that work hard in the classroom to do so many things for our children and for those that are going to college. And so I was glad that I was able to do that and to find projects that helped education and I hope helped teach other teachers that are out there.
Are there specific finds or discoveries that occurred to you that were unexpected during the course of that renovation?
Well, as I mentioned, we did that 18-month pre-construction phase, and one of the biggest surprises that we found, we had not anticipated any problems with the foundation of the house, but to be safe, they did test borings around the foundation. And houses of that period don't have foundations like we do today, but they really just started with a thicker course of brick and went up. And we found that two of those four walls were basically cookie crumbs. And if we had not known that before we went into the construction phase, that would have been the type of disaster we would have had that would have thrown us completely off schedule.
You've pointed out that one of the particularly unique challenges to this project is that no one lives in Mount Vernon, no one lives in Monticello, but the governor's mansion is a residence.
Exactly. There are, and I've had a wonderful opportunity or opportunities that have grown out of working on the executive mansion to become more familiar with Mount Vernon and with other historic homes. And it is a challenge when you're going to have people that live there day in and day out. They need the daily functions of showers and electricity and computer lines now and types of issues that other historic homes don't have. In fact, that was part of the title of my book, is that we were really preserving a historic home, but we had to make it adequate for families to live in this new century of electronics and the computer age.
Were there any contradictions that didn't allow people to move forward right away? You know, an historic precedent versus a modern update, such as accessibility, for instance?
Well, the house had never been accessible. There was not a single accessible restroom in the house, and that was an important piece that we believed had to be incorporated in the house. And sometimes blending those modern needs with historic properties is not always that easy, because with the larger space requirements that you have in order to accommodate certain things, you might have to take down a wall or you might have to move. One of the problems we discussed was having to move one of the historic arches in the central part of the house. So it was an effort to blend all of that to make it work together.
What about the furnishings? Any parts of the decor that might have filled the house, where did all of it come from?
Well, if you go back and look at the original inventories, which still exist at the State Library, the house was pretty Spartan, at least as far as furnishings that were supplied by the Commonwealth and that went into that Commonwealth inventory. In fact, they list mostly drapes, and I think the governor had a desk in his office in the mansion and a chair, and there was a table for the Jeffersonian monument or model of the Capitol. And that was about it on the earliest inventory, at least in the original governor's office in the House.
I know that many of the antiques in the governor's mansion are actually gifts from throughout the Commonwealth. Is that right?
They are. People have been very generous to the mansion with contributions and many of them period pieces that are appropriate to the time period of the house. There is only one that I'm aware of that I think there may be a new one that I don't know the provenance of. But when we were there, the only piece that we thought may have been at the mansion at one time. Well, in fact, that wouldn't have been either because we think it belonged to Patrick Henry. But Patrick Henry never lived in that house. The first 10 governors of Virginia lived in the governor's palace in Williamsburg. And a lot of people don't realize that the capital was originally in Williamsburg and then moved later to Richmond.
Okay. When we talk about that flow of gifts, how does that get managed? I would think there would be plenty of people clamoring to have their piece in the governor's mansion.
There are people that are, again, very generous and want to contribute. The house has limited space, however, and when we moved there in the basement of the old state library were rooms and rooms of furniture and drapes that had been discarded over time where one family would move in and would want to do it in the way that they wanted, and so everything from the prior governor would go into storage, and there really wasn't an inventory of any of that. A lot of it was becoming not useful any longer. So we had all of that to deal with as well. Sometimes you can't accept every gift that you're given. It's certainly not because you don't appreciate it, but it's just that it might serve a better purpose somewhere else.
For folks who have never had a chance to see the inside, can you give us a snapshot? I remember seeing at least one Duncan Fife, for instance.
Well, there is a Duncan Fife pier table in the front entry hall just as you come in. There is a New York case clock that is really spectacular. It dates to the 1790s that is also in the hall. I hesitate to give too much of a tour because I'm several governors away now, and they do tend to move the furniture around. But I believe that case clock will stay in the hall, and that's something that people really should look at if they go.
We're talking with First Lady Roxanne Gilmore about her book, Restoring the Virginia Governor's House, Preserving a Historic Home for a New Century. The website for the book is virginiagovernorshouse.com. And I'd like to read another excerpt from that web link. Characterized by restrained elegance, the house represents a locus of pride for the citizens of the Commonwealth and a physical link to its past. It helps tell the story of Virginia, an especially important role at a time when, as a people, we are not nearly as aware of our antecedents as we need to be effective citizens. History tethers Virginians and guides them well. Did this bring to you a closer tie to history? As you were doing this, did you feel that connection, or did it feel like an overwhelming renovation project, period?
It was actually a little bit of both of those feelings. Whenever you go in the mansion, you do get this sense of history and of the people that have been there and that have gone before, and that gives you a sense of pride and a sense that you want to do the best that you can, just as they have in the past. But then it was really an overwhelming project, too. All of the systems were in need, HVAC, plumbing, electrical, everything had to be replaced and updated. So it was really history meets living, to be sure.
And tell us who the architect and general contractor were.
The architect was John Paul Hanbury, with Hanbury Evans out of Norfolk. And he was assisted by Barbara Strickland Page, who was the interior design designer with that firm. And then the construction firm was Daniel & Company here in Richmond, that's headed by Sam Daniel and Mike Westcott.
What's interesting to me is, from a personal perspective, here you are still keeping your full-time position with Randolph Macon, teaching history, doing public appearances when needed as First Lady, and overseeing a renovation. This is in addition to being a wife and a mom. How'd you pull
that
off?
Well, I'm very fortunate because there was a lot of staff. They wouldn't let me drive, so I had somebody, you know, that was taking me places, and that's very helpful. So there are lots of willing hands that do things for you to give you extra time and to make your life easier. But it was busy, and I like being busy, though. And, again, I tried to incorporate my teaching into being First Lady, into making it part of what I was doing for the Commonwealth.
I'm interested in the project that you started back then, the website for teachers, Commonwealth of Knowledge. I know that it's gone through transitions, but tell us about that initiative.
Well, when Jim came into office, the standards of learning were newly being implemented. I believed that if they were going to have requirements like that for teachers, that teachers should be given resources in order to help them implement them in the classroom. And I'm a big believer in collaboration and in talking and in working together to make things happen. So I created a website called the Commonwealth of Knowledge where all of the SOLs were listed. If a teacher had a question about one, you could click on one, and it would have hot links to lesson plans that other teachers had found worked for them in the classroom, so they could get ideas about how they might implement a certain thing in their classroom and thus get teachers working together. It was a way of using the Internet and for communication and to make education better, I thought.
I think that's a great tie-in with what you do. Now, here's a question I've asked you in the past, but I think it's worth sharing with the curious audience members. Did you ever see ghosts while you were at the Executive Mansion?
I'm afraid I was not a ghost seer, but we had a lot of fun. I enjoy Halloween, and several Halloweens, we had opened the mansion and invited people to come, especially to bring their children in costume and come to the mansion. And we worked with the Richmond History Center, who sent their storyteller and had one of their reenactors dress up as the lady that people often claim that they see. And we would tell the ghost story out on the front lawn, and at the appropriate time, the reenactor would appear at the upstairs window and then vanish into the background. And the kids just thoroughly enjoyed that. And but that was the closest that I came to see the ghost.
And Governor Gilmore claims he didn't see anything either. Is that right?
I think he's never admitted it to me.
It's been a pleasure. Former First Lady Roxanne Gilmore and her book, Restoring the Virginia Governor's House, Preserving a Historic Home for a New Century. I know that you're available to discuss in public settings the book and talk about the historic significance of the renovation. The website to find out more is virginiagovernorshouse.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you, May Lily. I've enjoyed being with you today.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Virginia Conversations. I want to thank our guests, Feather Schwartz-Foster, author of First Ladies, From Martha Washington to Mamie Eisenhower, An Intimate Portrait of the Women Who Shaped America, and former Virginia First Lady Roxanne Gilmore, who authored the book Restoring the Virginia Governor's House, Preserving a Historic Home for a New Century. And of course, to you, our listeners, for tuning in to Virginia Conversations. I'm May Lily Lee. Have a great week.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.